Hello, this is Carl Sabatino, and this is Smith Sabatino. Roland, please.
Well, Carl, in this this segment, we have a very interesting guest. I first met our next guest more years ago than probably either one of us would like to think about, but if you promise, Carl.
I promise.
And I know that Andrew won't tell. I'll admit it was in the late 70s when both of us worked at WCBS-TV in New York. I was the anchor man there, and Andrew Hayward joined us as a news writer, and that was in 1976. And by the time he left the network 5 years later, he was my executive producer. He went on to work at CBS News for almost 25 years as a producer, executive producer, and eventually president of CBS News from 1996 to 2005. Since then, Andrew has immersed himself in the digital media revolution. He's considered a leading expert on how new media is changing journalism for the better, and I suppose, and you have, we have talked about many times, sometimes for the worse.
Many times.
Now he advises traditional and emerging companies on media strategy, and he's joining us today to talk about the changes that he's seen and what that means for all of us who care about news and information. Welcome, Andrew Hayward.
Thank you so much, Roland, and thank you, Carl.
It's a delight to talk to you again, my friend. Tell our listeners what it is you're doing today.
So I have my own advisory or consulting practice, and I work with a small number of companies on strategy. It's content and also digital strategy. Everybody's trying to figure out, given the massive changes in technology and in consumption habits, you know, how do you continue to reach people? How do you continue to build business models that will actually pay for news? Back when we first met, it was much simpler. And how do you continue to give people news that's verifiable, credible, useful to them? So there are a lot of issues that companies are dealing with, and I try to help. I'm interested in doing whatever small part I can to secure the future of journalism, given that it's changed so much.
Oh, boy, it sure has. If you were to characterize the changes in journalism from the time we worked together in the 70s to right now, how would you do that? What would you say? What's the sentence or two?
A shift in power from the producer to the consumer. That's not a complete sentence, Roland. I know you're a stickler for the King's English. Back when we started working together at WCBS, over at our network at CBS News, Walter Cronkite was still the anchorman. And he was the classic example of what one might call the one-to-many form of broadcast journalism. You know, Walter was so powerful and known as the most trusted man in America that, you know, when, about the only time in his career he ever did an editorial, it was against the Vietnam War, and it helped convince Lyndon Johnson not to run for re-election in 1968.
That's correct. Yep.
And the you know, the combined share of the three network evening newscasts was over 80%, meaning that more than four out of five sets that were turned on at that time were tuned to one of those three programs. You can't imagine any anchorman, as good as they are today, and they're terrific, having that kind of influence. Even though the evening news are still influential, it's an older crowd, a more traditional one, and for younger viewers, they have many, many more choices. And what's happened is that what used to be almost insurmountable obstacles to gathering news and to distributing it, it was very hard. You know, the equipment was heavy, it was expensive to transmit, nobody could, you know, is the equivalent of saying the people, you know, you have to have a printing press to have a newspaper, you have to have broadcast equipment to have a TV station. Now, you know, you, Carl, and I could start a publication with video today, and it would have global distribution immediately. And its success would depend on whether people liked it and shared it and told their friends about it, but we could do it. That's an incredible change.
And we could do it from any single spot on the planet Earth.
Correct. Any place that has a broadband connection, we could suddenly have the Roland, Carl, and Andrew channel.
Well, not even broadband, though. What about satellite connection is what I was referring to.
Yeah, well, but, right, but you wouldn't even need that. I mean, you would just be able to, you could just connect with
Wi-Fi, right,
and we would be, you know, up with our video on, you know, on Vimeo or YouTube, and we'd have a channel.
How do you answer the critics today who say that most of the information that comes from the Internet you can't trust?
Well, I think there's a very big issue there, and you know, I don't know whether it's most, but I certainly think there's a tremendous amount of information that is suspect, and that's for the very reason we've been discussing, that there's no, that anybody can be a quote-unquote journalist, anybody can be a quote-unquote publisher. And I'm not suggesting it needs to be a, you know, an arcane priesthood the way it might have been, you know, when we were starting out. But it's gone, I think, so far in the other direction that we need other safeguards. We're not going to put this genie back in the bottle, nor should we. Technology is a wonderful thing. You know, at its best, the democratization of media is a very exciting opportunity. But it's not what the founding fathers had in mind, because they built this country's democracy on a town meeting model where people would reach rough consensus, different opinions, but over a common set of facts. Now you can tailor the information you get so specifically to your own existing biases and prejudices, a kind of a cocoon of complacency, that no one actually is working off the same set of so-called facts, and it's very hard to get consensus. I think that's one reason Washington is so polarized, because many of the most active voters are also the most cocooned in their own media and information environments.
But
so to go back to your question, and I'm sorry to give you a long-winded answer, I think because the power has shifted to the consumer, the responsibility shifts there as well. I'm involved with a fascinating curriculum at Stony Brook University in New York State called News Literacy. We have a national center now which is trying to spread this curriculum with some success around the country and even to other countries overseas. And this actually gives news consumers of the future the tools they need to separate what's verifiable from what isn't, rumor from fact, the wheat from the chaff. Mm-hmm. Without that, I think we're going to have problems, Roland.
Andrew called Sabatino. One of the things that that is happening, and Roland knows this is a pet peeve of mine, it's not so much the technology. It is not so much the availability of being able to access or produce or deliver a news show. It's what's going on that news broadcast. It's the ability for these mostly young, some very talented news, quote unquote, reporters who don't seem to get it. It's not so much of being pretty. It's not so much being able to deliver to the marketplace. It's what you're saying. It's in the words. It's in the delivery, the fact checking, and all the things that have to be done. Maybe Walter, who I knew well, as Roland knows, later on in life, got it right the first time. And he came from that school with Edward R. Murrow, who said, we are the benchmarks of news, per se. We deliver it. It's up to the public to discern how good or how good it is not.
Okay. So you're saying, I think, if I want to make sure I understood you correctly so I respond properly, that you feel that the standard for what is now called the journalist has slipped since those days.
It's fallen off a cliff, personally.
Slipped and fell.
Yes.
To echo what you said a minute ago about, you know, what you'd actually meet guys back then who would say, you know, trust your mother, but check your facts.
Yes.
So I think it's a legitimate concern, and I'm going to give you kind of the pessimistic and the optimistic view. I'm going to be brief with the pessimistic view because you articulated it so well, Carl, and that is that, you know, style has overwhelmed substance, sizzle has overwhelmed steak, and, you know, if anybody can be a broadcaster, if technology enables that, then that rewards attractiveness and glibness rather than substance and hard work. That's the pessimist's view. The optimist view, and you know, you and Ronald will probably send people to come and cart me away after I say this, but the optimist view is that that there is a kind of the check and balance. Back in Walter's day, was the very strong editorial staff at CBS News, and of course at the other networks and at major newspapers. And those still exist at those places. The check and balance for the people of lower quality, you know, not operating quite at that high level, is the crowd itself. The optimists say, and there are evangelists, actually, they're beyond optimists, they're evangelists who say, in this new world of digital media, the crowd will correct mistakes, will point them out, and that you're heading for a new world of, and I'll use a couple of buzzwords here, transparency and authenticity. And they're actually, even though they're overused cliches, they are valuable words. Transparency meaning, you know, the means we use to gather news and to report it will be increasingly visible. It won't be kind of magic the way it does. It looked, you know, in the days when we were all you know, starting out in journalism, where it was kind of a little bit of a pay no attention to the man behind that curtain factor. It's, you know, you have a very media savvy generation who's hip to the tricks, who understands how things are done. So transparency will mean that, you know, we will be much more open about what we know, what we don't know, how we got the news, what we haven't gotten yet, and so on. And authenticity is a cousin of that, meaning that that those who are rewarded will not be the slickest and the prettiest, but the ones who actually are genuine, who seem to have real interests and real expertise. And the final thing I'll say is that we're headed for a world of narrower and narrower niches or niches. Now, I like to pronounce it niches because then I can use the pun, an embarrassment of niches, which is what we're headed for. But it's in that. So even though the downside of that is it moves us away from the common information culture that the founding fathers were counting on. The upside of it is you're going to have experts on everything.
All right, Andrew, so, I need to interrupt you because I'd like to ask you to hold over for the next segment with us.
Oh, am I going on too long? I'm sorry.
No, you're doing fine.
I'll be back
just,
when you're back.
I just want to say we'll be right back and stick with this. We'll be back with Andrew Hayward.
Now, Cheap Psych Tricks with Dr. Buff.
And Dr. Buff here. Are you a perfectionist, a person who strives for perfection in every conceivable way? Would you like to raise a perfectionist child? Well, you might want to rethink that. It's problematic from the start. Here's the science. Hard to believe, even though they work harder, perfectionists make less cash than their colleagues. They're lonelier, experience more guilt, and suffer from mood swings. And here's the coup de grace. If you're a perfectionist, your self-esteem is lower than your less than perfect friends. What's the cheap psychological trick? Perfectionists raise the standards so high they create their own failures and they can spiral out of control. So if this sounds like you, it's tough to admit, but you might want to seek some professional help. Got a question? Contact me at drbuff.com.
Don't complain about your cable bill going up and up and up. Do something about it. Grab a pencil and jot down this special number.
Call 888-359-MYTV.
Order in the court.
This is attorney Jay Coleman with the final verdict. This is the true story of Mike Anderson, who was convicted and sentenced for armed robbery back in 2000. But Mike was never told to report to prison, so he didn't, for 14 years. During that time, he got married, raised three kids, paid taxes, and worked a job. But when the error was finally discovered by the state, what happened to Mike? The final verdict after this.
Don't try to fight the IRS on your own. Use Coast One Financial Group and let them help you get a fresh start. Dial 877-219-8780. That's 877-219-8780.
Mike was sent to prison, but after a few days, a judge gave him 5,000 days credit due to the state's error and Mike's good conduct during his 14 years of freedom. And that's the final verdict.